Hi, I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop, and you have found the podcast Heroes in Our Midst. Thanks for doing that. Every week, we share a different story of someone we feel qualifies as a hero, not only because of some kind of amazing accomplishment, but because of the people that they are on the inside. In today's episode, we're talking to someone who has both of these things well in hand. He's a world champion curler who has a passion for passing the love of the game of curling onto as many young people as he can. I had the great fortune of chatting with Reed Carruthers via Zoom back in January of this year. Now, Reed has won a world championship as the lead for the Jeff Stoughton Rink and also started Camp Carruthers, which is a camp in the summer for young aspiring curlers. And since we have some of the world's best curlers right here in Manitoba, he truly brings the best curlers together to give back. An amazing experience. Of course, there's much more to Reed's story than that, including his willingness to name one of his teammates as skip to the present team that he formed as his own because he just knows it's a better call for the team. And how perfect is this for timing? They just qualified for the Olympic trials last week. So his is a story of determination and dedication to his sport, an unrelenting passion to be the very best he can be and to do whatever it takes to make it so. So let's go to the easiest starting point of any conversation. I thanked Reed Carruthers for joining us.
Well, thank you. What a tremendous honor to be asked on the podcast. I've listened to a couple of the episodes so far. I'm a big fan. I've known Adrian for 10 plus years, and I've been able to meet you a couple times as well. So to be asked to this is just, this is cool.
Well, you know what? I think it's been super cool for me because I've seen you curl, cheered you on, watched you with Jeff Stoughton and all that. But now to get to know you as a person, which is really our mission in Heroes, is to sort of say, we see you as a hero and some of the things you've accomplished, but not just on the ice. We want others to know what that is so that we can all put some of these things to practice in our own lives. So we don't have to be a world champion curler, but we can know some of the qualities that, you know, you really strive to put into your life that makes you a hero to us. So Reed, obviously everyone's story starts somewhere, and that's kind of been the theme of Heroes is we take you right back. We take people back to sort of the beginning, and curling isn't always necessarily the most mainstream of sports for school kids. I mean, we think about ice, we think about hockey in Canada. We also think about curling because we've got some amazing ones, but where did you start?
No, I didn't start on the curling ice, I'll tell you that. I played a numerous amount of other sports when I was growing up, anything from volleyball to basketball, school sports. I was a big baseball fan, golf, and hockey was my winter passion for sure. But my parents were curlers, not at a super high level, but enough that, you know, they enjoyed the sport and would drag us out to the rink when we were a young age. And I had an older sister that was curling. So my parents just, I wouldn't say they forced me into curling, but they said, you know what, you should really give this a try for a winter. I believe I was around 12 or 13 years old. And, you know, I really haven't looked back since. I've been playing 36 now, and I've been playing ever since that day. So
when you went with your parents first to the curling rink, did you go with them? Did you actually play with them?
Yeah, so I'd go with them. They would play in like a men's league and a women's league, you know, and my sister would play in a junior league. So I would get to go and watch. But my first actual time on the ice was at the Fort Rouge Curling Club as part of like the junior program. And, you know, throwing the first couple of rocks down the sheet, I had a lot of fun. So, you know, that was the big part of it is I had fun and it made me want to come back again.
So at 12 or 13, you started curling. Now, did you have some friends that curled with you? I mean, I know that age as a kid in sport, we kind of look for, well, what are my peers doing? What are they doing? Sometimes it seems to me that I know my own boys growing up, they wanted to play soccer. You know why? While one of them loved soccer, the other one, he didn't even love soccer. All his friends were playing. So how did that play out for you? Did you either sort of recruit some friends or did you have some friends playing?
Yeah, that's I think one of the trickiest things about, you know, I'll speak on curling in general is how do you really get into it? And that was the challenge for me. Joining Fort Rouge, they had a really good setup. So they had a good junior coordinator, and he would handpick almost like older mentor style junior skips. So people that are under the age of 20, and they would work with the younger curlers. So I would be 12, you know, I was 12, 13 years old. And I had like an 18-year-old skip who was really wacky, goofy, kind of funny guy, and his name was Cameron Owens, and Cam was an absolute treat on the ice. And, you know, he made me want to keep coming back. He never made me feel like I was inadequate on his team. You know, he was really good for mentoring me and making me want to come back. And I have to say that the Fort Rouge Curling Club did a fantastic job of helping to incorporate, you know, these new curlers into the system.
So you get started in a lot of kids start in a sport, and that's all nice, but you're a world champion, Reed. When did you get really serious about it?
That's a good question. You know, I would still say I'm still having a ton of fun doing it, but like, you know, the first couple years, you know, it wasn't really about being competitive. After maybe a couple years of playing in the junior program, even just once a week, you know, I'm a competitive guy, and I kind of wanted to take this to the next level. I knew there was tournaments and things that I could play in. So with my parents' help, they were able to link us up with three other younger curlers that were like-minded like me, actually at the St. Patel Curling Club. So then I was playing 2 weeks, once with more of a competitive junior team at the age of 15, and still in my fun league at Fort Rouge. And from there, you know, I started playing in junior playdowns and provincials and tournaments, and it became the, you know, 3-4 times a week with practice and starting to commit a little bit more to the sport.
So when you were 15, were you sort of destined to be a skip? How did that sort of play out for you? And how does that play out in curling? How do you end up being a lead or a second or a third or a skip?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, you know, and because every position is important. Some people have leadership qualities. Some people like to be the leader on the team. For me, when I was starting to get into competitive, I actually played a front end position. So I was playing lead, and then I was playing second. And we lost a provincial junior final at the age of 15 to Matt Wozniak, who is a longtime second of Mike McEwen, and still very close with him. He's still playing competitive. He's on a rival Jason Gunlitson's team now. But, you know, after losing that final, it kind of did something in me. It made me want to, you know, strive for more rather than, you know, stick with the same team. I was having a lot of fun, but I wanted to try something new. I wanted to be that leader on the team. And from there, you know, I left the team and I took our lead with me, Adam. I'd become really close friends with him. And, you know, I started skipping at the age of 16, and, you know, I skipped all the way up until 25. So from juniors into the first 5 years of men's before the opportunity to play with Jeff Stoughton arose.
So Reed, saying you play with Jeff Stoughton is no small potatoes. How did that come to be? Like, how did you become part of his team?
It was an interesting way that it came about. You know, when I got into men's curling, I really started to get competitive in the sport, and we started to travel. I curled had Jason Gunlitson on our team, and we had a good group of guys that were willing to travel and try to take curling to the next level, take our skills and try to develop them even further. And I would say that, you know, there were some times where, you know, I knew Jeff Stoughton was practicing, and, you know, I'd go to the same club, just try to let it be known that, hey, you know, like I'm putting the effort in. Teams aren't all, you know, they don't last for very long periods of time. So if there was ever going to be an opportunity to get on, you know, someone like Jeff Stoughton's team, you know, at that age, I knew it was going to be an awesome opportunity. And I guess Jeff took notice, and it was actually at one of the Grand Slam curling events in Winnipeg. Longtime lead of Jeff, Steve Gould, sat down next to me and gave me the, hey, what are you doing next year? So at that point, you know, I let it be known that I'd be interested. I was actually teaching full-time in a term position, J.H. Bruns. But, you know, my passion for curling, I'd like to say, like, look, I'd like to give this opportunity a chance before I go back to teaching full-time. So Stoughton actually gave me a call a couple days later, you know, and then from there, you know, we started to do some planning. We did some talking, some discussing, because it's not just about, hey, you know, do you want to curl next year? There has to be some sort of planning that goes into that process. So we had a few conversations, and, you know, we made it formal and informed our team, and we had a great four-year period.
You know, Reed, I just think that's incredible. I sort of want to go back to that moment where you had the opportunity, and you sort of started to know that, oh, Like I might be able to curl with Jeff Stoughton, but I also like your jam in like saying, hey, I know when he practices. Like, was that always how you have been? You always like, and didn't, were you nervous at all? Like sort of approaching that whole situation?
Yeah. Well, I would say I'd be nervous if I hadn't spent time around them and their team and all the other, you know, that's the one thing with curling is it's one of those sports where if you want to go and sit next to an Olympic champion in a rink, you can do that. You have access to them. You know, I can't say the same thing about a professional NFL player or hockey player. You know, you never see them. You never get that opportunity. So for me, you know, I already had a bit of a friendship with Jeff and some of the guys on the team. So it wasn't completely out of left field, but it was kind of like a couple years of talking back and forth and work to get that opportunity.
Yeah. You've talked about it a bit, the changing of teams, and sometimes from the outside looking in, those of us in some different sports, we think like, ooh, like how is that going to go relationship wise? And I think the general public kind of likes the story or whatever, but it doesn't seem to be it. Like you're even saying it now, like that is something that happens. Is that just a regular thing? That's what happens as curling teams evolve.
Yeah, curling teams definitely evolve. I think the mixing of players happens lots. You know, there's only a certain amount of people that are willing to take on curling as like a full-time commitment. And I think, you know, we have almost like a limited player pool. Although we have so many amazing curlers here, there's a lot of really good curlers that they want to work full-time and not travel and play as much as what some of the top level athletes are willing to do. So I think I was in one of the tiers of, hey, look, like I want to do the work. And Jeff recognized that. And I think that's why that opportunity came about. And I think that's why you continue to see that, you know, if we fast forward a little bit, I'm curling with Mike McEwen now, and he was a rival of me even before like I had played on Jeff's team. He was another great young team that was playing. And, you know, we played against each other for a very long period of time. And then I played with Jeff's team, played against him for another 4 years, and then another 4 years of skipping on my own after that. So, you know, and now we've mixed teams. It's one of those things that kind of comes about. You admire people, you want to learn from new teammates, and it also brings on new challenges and almost like renews your commitment to the sport.
Yeah, I think that's such a cool concept, actually. And it, like you say, the whole renewal of that, like you just get a whole new charge, and maybe it's another, you know, great 4 year run. I'd like to go back to that 4 year run though with Jeff Stoughton, like leading up to your, you know, your world championship and all that. When you're that good, obviously by then, Reed, you were good. You know, just get on that team and then get good. To be on that team, you have to be pretty world-class. So what do you do when you're training a group of you guys? We see coaches at competitions and stuff, but they don't seem to, I mean, you guys run the show, the skip runs the show. Explain at that level, how do you improve? Who, you know, are you coaching each other? What's the dynamic of that? Like, tell us a little bit about that behind the scenes.
Yeah. So curling's an interesting sport in the fact that, you know, our leader is almost like the skip. He's almost like, he or she is almost like the boss. So everyone has a very important role on the team, and definitely a coach is of the utmost importance. And I've had some really amazing coaches, but there's kind of like the hierarchy where the coaches, you know, depending on what you're asking of the coach before the season starts, they have a different level of role. With Jeff's team, when I first joined the team, Jeff was like the boss, and you know, he was like our fearless leader. And for me, playing with him was really easy because, you know, I was able to focus on a different role, learning how to be a front ender again, because I hadn't done that for so many years. But yeah, you know, we each have a very important role to get to the next level in curling. It requires a lot of training on and off the ice. A lot of people don't recognize curlers as being in great shape, but I'll tell you what, we spend a lot of time in the gym, working hard, so that we can be not only really good at sweeping, recovery time, brushing as hard as you can. Your job as a front ender in particular is to get the most out of everyone else's shots. So you only have 2 of 8. So, you know, for me, it was about trying to make not only Steve, but John's and Jeff's shots behind my own. And shot making as well, kicking out of the hack requires strength. And then also working with sports psychologists, you know, you miss a shot, you have to be able to rebound and make your next one.
You know, I think the mental part of curling is crazy. When you think of a Bonspiel, that's one thing that has really blown me away. I love watching curling, but when you watch a curling Bonspiel, you're watching for days. Now, if we're watching for days, you guys are playing for days. You know, that's why when you see a team, you know, go undefeated or nearly undefeated, it's just an incredible, incredible thing. Now, and because it doesn't move so quickly, you have so much time to think. Maybe if I dig into that a little bit, since you brought it up anyway, did you think differently? Did you approach it differently when you were different positions? And how do you master that? And maybe who are some of the best people you know that did that?
Oh, yeah. Great question. Well, I would say I learned a lot from just the first year of playing with Jeff, John, and Steve. You know, they're consummate professionals. My approach changed big time to curling and how I prepare, not just for regular tournaments, but things like the provincials, the Brier. It's like a war, you know, you're bang on when you say, look, like, you know, these Bonspiels go on for days. The Brier, as an example, goes on for a full week. So to be on for that, you know, that amount of time, and curling games are 2.5-3 hours long. It's a big time mental challenge, and sports psychology is an absolute massive part of our game. So for me, you know, the learning experience that I got playing with Jeff, in particular, in the first couple of years was it's life changing. It's changed how I approach curling from that point even to now. But I would say, you know, he was one of those guys that knew how to get the most out of his teammates when it mattered most. He could keep it light in the regular tournaments, but you knew. When Jeff was dialed in and acting like a fearless competitor out there, it was very inspiring, and it made us better as teammates.
That's so cool. You can just ride on that strength, and then it becomes something you know how to produce as well. I love that. I love that feeding off each other. The other thing I think about with curling is you watch a lot of sports, and you guys have to just keep it together. Like if you make the best shot, like you get the best takeout in the second end or something or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I even think about you in that respect, those playing sort of lead and second, like you're not always, you're setting up those, you know, those first shots. You don't get that release. What is that mm-hmm. like for you as a competitor, and how do you deal
with that? Yeah, I would say it's a mental contest, especially when you're playing against the other top teams. You have to not show weakness out there because we feed off that. And I know from playing at a high level for a long time, when I see competitors, you know, including opposing skips, start to show some weakness or a little bit of jitters, you pounce on that. So, you know, I'm not going in tackling Brad Jacobs, but you know, if I see him miss a shot or get frustrated and bang his broom, show frustration, you might change your game plan, and you have to be smart about when you take those risks and when you really go at a team or whether you hold back and play possum. There's definitely a chess game that goes on the ice mentally.
Well, it's pretty cool to watch the fierce competitors that you guys are. And okay. So I want to talk about the World Championship. Maybe talk through that competition or some of your best memories from it.
I would say playing on Stoughton's team, I was a little bit nervous before that season started, you know, whether I would measure up to my teammates, make sure that I, you know, wasn't letting them down because I was playing with world champions. So it was one of those things where I had that pressure, but I really didn't feel nervous. I almost had the relief. It was great that I was playing front end because I had John Mead and Jeff Stoughton behind me. So for me, I always had like that security blanket of, hey, you know, I told myself, you know, do my best, try to make my shots, do everything that I can. But I have that security blanket behind me that if I do mess up, they're there to go and make the shot. So that helped. It helped me learn to win before, you know, rather than getting too nervous about making shots or missing shots. You know, I was part of a team that was able to win, and I started to win often with them. But if we fast forward to the world, so I was never really nervous at the Brier, even the Brier final. I wasn't all that nervous because I was just having fun. It was my first Brier ever. But then once we got to the Worlds, I actually got nervous. You know, we were playing in Regina. We had through the round robin, we went through almost undefeated. We lost to Team Norway in our last game. Didn't have an impact on the standings, so that was fine. But when we got to the playoffs, you know, playing the, I guess, the 1-2 game, a little bit nervous in that game, we won. But now I have to sit around for a day waiting to see who we play against. So before the final, and the crowd support there was amazing in Regina, just like any sporting event. Saskatchewan always does a fantastic job of hosting. They have crazy fans. So we went from, you know, representing Manitoba at the Brier to now being Canada and wearing our colors. And this is the first time I'd ever been Team Canada at anything ever in my career. So I'll use this story as an example. Before the final, they would always pipe you out from the tunnel. So they announced Team Scotland first. And, you know, I knew it was a packed crowd because you could hear them even when you're behind in the tunnel. So when they were walking us out, the crowd went absolutely bananas. It was almost like AC/DC Thunderstruck was going on. It was just boom, boom, boom. And then I got really nervous because now it's like, oh, we're playing for them. It's not just about us four and our coach and our fifth man. Like now we are Canada and like we better win. So I was nervous. The first, we play a 10-end game. The first five ends, I was struggling a little bit, but El Capitano Jeff was as fearless as ever. And he made an absolute beauty to get us out of trouble in a couple of the ends early in the game. And once that happened and he made a couple of those shots, I kind of took it all in, looked around, you know, I was starting to really get accustomed to like the environment and the feeling that I was having and the jitters. And I just decided, look, like this is my chance. Like it's time not only to make my shots, but like make sure that I'm focusing on judging the rock, helping my teammates make their shots. And we went on cruise control and didn't really look back. And, you know, after Jeff made the last shot in the last end, the game ended up not being all that close, but it was just an absolutely surreal experience. And I'll forever remember that. Thank goodness for all the pictures I have on my phone and in the video recordings, because I can get to go and relive it once in a while. But that experience alone was life altering.
So great. So after that, what happened then for your curling? What did you take on after that world championship?
So that was actually the first year of our quadrennial together. So the team, we stuck together for 4 years. We made one change after the second season. We parted ways with Steve Gould and brought in a new lead who was already an Olympic champion, Mark Nichols. So he actually moved from Newfoundland to come to Winnipeg and made a commitment to the team, which was pretty amazing. It was a very tough search to come up with a new teammate for us. But one of the big things for Jeff and John in particular, for me, you know, I still was looking like I had a curling career, you know, after this quadrennial was over. But for them, it was kind of like their last real chance to go to the Olympics. And they had lost the Olympic trials final to Gushue and Mark Nichols. Yeah, in 2006 or so. Before the Torino Olympics. And for them, they were bringing on a guy that, you know, had been there, done that, won an Olympic gold medal, and we were bringing on another winner onto our team. So we curled another 2 years with Mark, got to play in the, you know, we did really well. We were ranked as high as number one on the Canadian ranking system in our third year together. And then going into our fourth year, which is the Olympic quadrennial year, Winnipeg hosted the Olympic trials. And our team was probably one of the top four favorites in the trials. You had Kevin Martin, Glenn Howard, Brad Jacobs, Gushue, like all the top names are all competing in this, in the trials. But we, you know, we didn't have the success we wanted. We ended up finishing out of the playoffs, and it kind of marked the end of our run together as a team. And from there, I decided, you know what, like I've been a skip for a number of years. I've had an absolutely fantastic experience playing with these guys, but it was time to go back to being the leader and starting my own thing. And that's kind of, you know, what's gotten me to this point today.
And what do you love about skipping? Were you longing sort of for that? Like you said, you wanted to sort of take charge again?
Yeah, I'd learned so much that I really love teaching. You know, I'm a teacher by trade. So for me, being in charge of a classroom, helping others is just something that I thrive after. It motivates me. So being a leader on a curling team is kind of the same thing as being in charge of a classroom. You know, it's, yes, you're teammates, but you're kind of guiding them. You're being a little bit of the boss. And I did really enjoy that. So for 4 years, I skipped. We did really well. We made the Olympic trials in Ottawa. We finished fourth. So we did well. We weren't the team that won, but, you know, we had a really good run. And I kept three of the same teammates moving forward into our current team. And we brought on our longtime rival, Mike McEwen, to skip our team. And that's where we are today.
Okay, so I want to go through that a little bit. So you decided to become a skip. You put together this team and now you've brought Mike on and he's skipping your team now. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. It was an interesting transition. Our first year together was, you know, we had some flashes of brilliance and some disaster as well, because we had two alphas that were trying to run the game and be in charge of the team. And, you know, we had a power struggle in a way of, you know, who's going to be the leader. We even tried, I would call the game and Mike would throw last rocks. And then there was a period of me actually throwing last rocks and skipping, as well as him throwing last rocks and skipping and me playing third. And that's what we've settled on. And it seems to work really well now. We've really started to gel. But, you know, you're blending two different game styles, which was one of the things that we struggled with, and also throwing technique. Curlers throw the rock certain ways, like to do it certain ways. So, you know, I'd done it for years. He had done his way for years, but we've kind of made this blend of what works for us. And I would say it's really successful.
Okay. So have you literally changed how you throw your rocks?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. How you release the handle, where you put the broom down. That was one of the things that we weren't all that in sync with in our first year. And we even struggled with it just a little bit at the start of our second year together. We're now playing in our third year, COVID year, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But the Brier last year was probably when we really, really started to click and we played really well. And I feel like now when Mike puts the broom down for me, he knows exactly what to expect out of me as a thrower and vice versa. And the same can be said about Derek and Colin, who play second and lead on our team. We're really in sync now. And, you know, it's exciting for us. We just really hope we get to play here sometime in the future.
Now, going back to making a decision like that, and I'm glad you brought up the alpha male thing. I mean, it's true. I mean, even in female sports, there are alphas amongst us. And that's what makes me so curious, in that there's an element of humility in being able to be a teammate to someone that you are now agreeing, I think it works better this way. Now, some might see that as, wow, you gave up the position of skip. But I'm hearing when you're speaking, there's a strength to what you're saying, in that, why would we not do what makes the most sense? Was there a moment, though, at any point where you went, oh, I wish I could be skipping this team, or why can't it work when I'm skipping?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. The process was definitely not easy. And that was probably what was holding us back, too, is that, you know, I wasn't giving in, and neither was he. But, you know, now that I'm looking back on it, do I have a regrets for how we handled it? Maybe a little bit. But, you know, we had to have some really constructive conversations about growth as a team. And, you know, why did we put ourselves together if we're not willing to do everything and anything to try to win? So, you know, with some time and some work and some really constructive talks, we were able to come to an agreement that this makes the most sense. And I would say also, it was about learning about how to, for me, fulfill that, you know, being in charge portion of it was a big thing. You know, feeling important, almost like I still had some sort of control, was a big thing, because I didn't really want to be the person that completely gave all the control over. So for me, you know, I run our team account. I help book practices. So like I have other duties on the team that help me feel, you know, like I'm a very important part of this team. But also it's good because it takes some of the burden off Mike. I'll give an example. Jeff kind of ran everything when I curled with him. He would do all the bookings, all the flights, because we don't have a manager to do any of this. So there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. And in most teams, the skip kind of does that. So we did a lot of delegating. And I think that actually helped with our team, is just figuring out how do we kind of make everyone happy, and what does that look like?
What a great lesson to learn, and talk about true teamwork. And I think it happens in a lot of sports, but I think in a lot of sports, the coach just makes the decisions. So whether you like it or not, it wasn't really up to us as teammates to discuss with each other who would have what role. And I think that's really unique in curling. And you really had to take a step back there. And man, may I just say kudos to you guys, because being as competitive as you are, and as and you all know you're great at the game. It's just a matter of finding out how those pieces are going to fit together best. It's not really about better or worse or first or last. It's all about togetherness.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, there was a lot of voices that a lot of people chirping in the backgrounds about the dynamic of our team and saying it wasn't going to be successful. It wouldn't work. And part of that dialogue that I was hearing almost made me want to work harder at it. And that's part of what working with Adrian, my sports psychologist, Adrian, has done absolute wonders for me is, you know, it's the bulletin board material, what drives some athletes to work harder and prove the doubters wrong. So for me, that was a big part of it.
You know, this has spurred on in my mind lessons that can be learned again from a team sport. And speaking of lessons, and you've talked about how teaching is a passion of yours, you have really brought that into reality with your curling camp. You do this, and it's a big deal. And I want you to tell us about it, because I think there aren't many camps in sports like where world champions coach and national champions, and you have something really good going for junior curlers. And when was that born? And let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, growing up in the support, when I started to really get into it at that 14, 15 year old age, I would go to a summer curling camp, and that's something that was ran. There was some that went on in Gimli. I would go, you'd go for a week, have a great time. And it's always in the summertime. And then it would get you fired up for the curling season. So I had done that for years and when I was in juniors. And then with the teaching background, I decided, you know, teaching at these camps was something that I would also really enjoy. It's, I get to go back to camp and have fun, but this time just get paid for it. So it was a really good fit with the teaching background. So there hadn't been a curling camp in Winnipeg or Manitoba for a few years. There was one in Morden for a long time after the Gimli camp, but it had been a few years since a camp like the one that I'm running now had gone on. And, you know, I knew a junior coordinator out of St. Vitale, Guy Beaudry, who is very passionate, we'll say, about junior curling. And he's got an absolutely wonderful junior program going on. And it was from dialogues with him back and forth about maybe setting something up and running a summer curling camp again. So, you know, we've had 5 years of the camp. Unfortunately, last year with COVID, we were unable to run, but we've had five successful years of the camp. It's been an absolute treat to have that as my, almost like my summer job, my summer passion to work towards. And I'm looking forward to doing it again, but I run it almost like a U of M day camp. So kids will come in for a week. It's very similar. So it's like a 8:30 to 4 p.m. So parents can drop their kids off from work. It's a junior camp. So anyone under the age of 20 and all levels of juniors can participate. But I'll have an average of 100 to 140 kids that will sign up over a 2 week period. Wow. For two separate 1 week camps. And I even have some crazy campers that come for 2 weeks. We're very fortunate. And one of the big things that I think that's made this camp successful is in Manitoba, we have some of the world's best curlers. So I've got people, I've had Jill Officer, Caitlin Laws, Mike's taught at the camp, Colin's taught at the camp, Team Einerson, Shannon and Brianne have taught at the camp. I've got the list goes on. Matt Dunstone, many, many curlers that are very passionate about the sport, but also are still, you know, competing at a high level. So these kids see these curlers on TV playing. So I really wanted to run a camp that the kids were going to have, you know, a week of working with this athlete as their coach. And I think it's really inspiring for the kids. I know my instructors love teaching as well. Because they always ask, hey, if you need someone for next year, you know, I'd be happy to come back. So it's really worked out. It's something that I'm very passionate about and I want to keep doing moving forward. Even when I'm done competitive curling, I'll be teaching this camp.
I love it. I just think it's really impressive too, because you are still competing. And how do you, by the way, you're running a camp and you're, you know, how do you find enough time to throw enough rocks to be at the caliber you're at?
Yeah, it's tough. The 2 week period during the camp, I do put my own curling preparations on hold. I always hold it the last 2 weeks of August, and our season normally kicks off September long weekend, maybe even a week after that. So for me, you know, I spend all summer preparing for this. We don't actually throw rocks during the summer until the camp starts. So some of my teammates will come in and start throwing some stones during that period. But we really ramp up our own curling once the camp is over, me in particular. And it's just one of those things that I find I get really excited about my own curling after teaching the kids to play.
So with a junior camp like that, are you pretty excited about the, sort of the future of curling? I mean, you know, are there a lot of junior curlers? Are you always hoping to find more? Is Canada in a good position for the future of curling?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I'd say I'm a little bit nervous. We've had good enrollment. I think there's a lot of junior curlers that are playing competitive and having fun. I'm a little bit worried about, you know, when I first got into curling and just playing once a week and just playing to play the sport and enjoy it, I'm worried about that level of participation. I think there needs to be some thinking that goes on for how do we get more people involved in the sport, whether it's at a young age or even into adult curling, in order to keep the future of the sport going. There definitely needs to be a change because the numbers are starting to go down a little bit. We're seeing even less curling clubs in across Canada that are open. Some are closing almost year by year. So that is a little bit concerning about the future of the sport.
Now, how long will you play, Reed Carruthers? How long are you going to keep going?
Yeah, good question. For as long as my wife lets me, I guess. it's one of those things where I thought maybe this might be my last quadrennial, but you know, I'm 36 now. I feel like I got at least another quad in me. So I want to keep going. I don't know when that time will come, or you know what my avenue will be after that. It could be something in teaching. It could be back to the school setting. It could be a whole different, you know, avenue altogether. It could be coaching, competitive. I'm not sure, but for now, I'm really really happy with where I am and what I've done in the sport and about my future with my own team.
Nice. What do you think is the number one thing you love about curling? Why curling?
Yeah, I would say the camaraderie, the people that I've met. You know, if I grab my phone right now and loaded up my text messages, I would say that 90% of the text messages that I have right now are all just whether they're fellow competitors or teammates. It's a tight knit community, but it's almost like a family, and you can play against a guy and then go upstairs and have a beer with him afterwards. You can't really do that in other sports. So that's the one thing. I've got to travel the world, go and see some absolutely amazing places and meet some great people. And that's the one thing about curling that you just can't beat.
Well, you know, and if you want to find a place to curl, I think Canada is one of the best places ever. We've got a lot of ice, we've got a lot of cold, and we've got a lot of champions to follow in their footsteps. So
yeah, that's for sure.
My final question before we get to the rapid fire questions, mm-hmm. Do you think this group you have together now has what it takes to make it all the way? Do you have that goal? Do you guys talk about that?
Oh yeah, 100%. For me, you know, being able to win a Brier with Stoughton was in world championship was amazing. You know, Colin and Derek, I've been teammates with them for longer than I have with Mike, and I've wanted to share that experience with them, and I feel like they have the drive and the work ethic to do that. And I have to say, like, after years and years of playing against Mike, he's one of those guys that, you know, I feel would be very deserving of a Brier championship if he ever won, like with how good of a curler he is and how close he's been. It's one of those things where I just feel like this team, we definitely have what it takes to win, but there's so many really, really good teams, especially right now. I'm not going to say, look, like we're for sure going to win, but I would say that we're going to be one of those teams that definitely has a good chance.
Right on. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And I'm inspired already, but we have some rapid fire questions. And so let's start right here. What is your favorite sound?
Okay, I'm going to go with the sound of a rock sliding down the sheet. And it has to be when you're on your own throwing a rock in an empty curling club. So it's just, it's almost, the silence is deafening. But then once you let go of the rock, hearing it slide down on the pebble is one of the things that I think of, even if I need a break from reality, is I just close my eyes and think about what it's like to throw a stone.
What does being unapologetically human mean to you?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I would say that, you know, this is one that I've struggled with. It's striving too much to be perfect, but you have to be okay with who you are and what you do. You know, I care personally too much about image and branding and, you know, representing our sponsors correctly and portraying myself with a good public image. But no one is perfect. And we have to be able to recognize that and learn from our experiences and our mistakes.
Awesome. Okay. Do you have a favorite crazy story that's happened to you?
So in curling, there's an event that goes on. It's almost like the Ryder Cup in golf, where, you know, you play with another country and you represent the world. So in curling, we have what's called the Continental Cup, and it's Canada and the US versus the world's teams. And it's a very competitive contest. And I've got to be on Team North America for a couple years throughout my curling career. One in particular, we were in Vegas and the competition was really close, and I had a very skinny, tricky double to win the competition, and I made it, and I helped win for North America. And that experience of having my teammates jump over the boards and come and hug me and have that celebration, that would have been a curling memory or experience that I would like to share and relive again. Cause, you know, words can't describe, especially in Vegas with all the fans cheering for us. It was pretty cool.
What does hope mean to you?
Yeah, hope's a good one. You could say like it's the power to believe that you can achieve anything or that anything is possible. Hope is what keeps me going, you know, even in the times that we're in right now with COVID. Hope keeps me going. It helps keep me going forward, that, you know, knowing that I'll always have something to look forward to, and we're not going to be living in this, you know, environment that we are forever.
I love it. Anything is possible. I absolutely love that. What is your biggest takeaway? You've led us into sort of the thoughts on COVID. What is your biggest takeaway from the great pause?
Yeah, I would say the biggest takeaways I'd say is like, I've really enjoyed my time with my family. Although I haven't been able to be around my extended family, I've spent a lot more time with my wife and my fur baby, Jake, who's anxiously awaiting a walk. I would say, you know, this has been like an amazing mental reset. I find the curling season to be a huge grind. It's very long. It's almost like a 9-month period. And with practice every day and competing and traveling, I would say this has been almost like a reset for me. So the pause has been a reset for me.
Who is the bravest leader you know, and why is that? And what elements of humanness do they display and allow others to display?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know personally, but I would use someone like Barack Obama as an inspiration, someone to be the first African-American president in US history, and to do what he did throughout his presidential race. I guess I'm appreciating him more in what he's done for us as people in this world in comparison to what we're seeing now down south. So I would use him, and you could pick a whole slew of things that he did during his run as president.
What is an example of the best in humanity that you have seen during this time?
Yeah. Okay. So here's a good one. So I'm living in North Kildonan, and I'm on a community Facebook page. I got an alert for a missing lost dog. So took Jake, jumped in the truck and started driving around. Well, 2 weeks later, about 20, 30 people later in a group chat, every day spending countless hours searching for this dog, he was happily returned to its owner on my birthday. So 2 weeks of being out in the cold on his own and countless hours of volunteers who did not even know the owner helping return this dog back to safety. That was the best birthday present I could have asked for.
Isn't that amazing? And probably because of this time, people had the time and then gave it.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. Who are two or three people who have influenced you, Reed, and how did they impact your life?
Oh, yeah, I could have a whole list. Okay, so 100% I got to go with my wife. She pushes me every day to be a better person from the day I met her. I've always wanted to not only be in her good books, but to, you know, impress her and do things for her. And I just know as a person in general, I'm a lot better because of being around her every day. And then I'll also go with, you know, my parents split and remarried, and I got a whole bunch of parents, but I'll use my mom and my dad as in particular. So my mom, I would say she's inspired me because she is the hardest working and the biggest rock someone could ever ask for. You know, you could throw, like, she's had so many things thrown her way, but she is always so strong, and she herself is a leader among leaders, and just always shows strength and always seems to find the positive and always has a way of, you know, making the people around her act the same way. And then my dad, I would use my dad as an inspiration as well. He's one of the kindest people that I've ever met in my entire life. You know, the guy doesn't even swear. Like, he literally just tries to do nice things all day, every day. So I've always looked up to that.
Well, you've had obviously some good mentors and good people that have been surrounding you, and now you're doing the same. We just thank you for being around us for about an hour. And you know what I love is often I go into these conversations and I'm so excited to talk to someone because they're a world champion. And then every time we get to the end and I'm like, I'm so excited I got to chat with you because of the person that you are. Thanks for inspiring us. You are a hero in our midst, no question.
Thank you so much. That's probably the nicest compliment someone's ever given me. So, okay, thank you. Thanks for your time.
That's Reed Carruthers. Watch for him as third, second, Derek Samogalski, lead, Colin Hodgson, and skip, Mike McEwen, at the Olympic Trials, November 20th to 28th. And when you watch, now you'll know Reed's journey. And you'll know the human behind the performance. And no question, we'll be cheering him on. So that's all for today's episode. And if you liked it, then share it, follow us, tag us, subscribe to Heroes in Our Midst, and check out our website, heroesinourmidst.ca, to find all of our past episodes as well. So many inspiring stories in a time when that seems to be just what we need. I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop. Thanks for listening.